Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Peter Buckingham, who I believe is one of Australia's foremost experts in site location strategy and strategic network design. If you're trying to figure out where you should put your next location or assess whether it's performing to its revenue potential in its area, then Peter's the guy to listen to. I've known Peter since 2012, and since then he's helped a number of my successful CEOs with their businesses to analyze the optimal locations for their next site or to better understand the actual or potential performance of an existing site. Peter, welcome.
Thank you very much, John. It's great to be here.
So, Peter, today we're going to talk about both how medium business CEOs can analyze the optimal locations for their next site and to better understand the actual or potential performance of an existing or future site. But first, tell me a little bit about network planning and demography in general. How did you first get into deciding where to put sites and how to assess a site's performance? How did that journey evolve?
Okay, well, thank you for the opportunity to have this chat today, John. Look, I've been at this game a long time, and I guess my start off was I worked for Caltex for 20 years. And one of my roles in Caltex was property manager. I'd done various roles in all different states in Australia. I was wholesale manager, Western Australia. I was country sales manager for Victoria. Different roles. And I became property manager about 91 for Victas South Australia. And my life at that stage was, how do you decide where to put service stations? I was fortunate enough to go overseas for a year with Caltex and actually develop the processes which we introduced to about 40 different countries, right from sort of developed markets like Australia and New Zealand and maybe South Africa, right through to Tanzania, Kenya, countries that Caltex operated in worldwide. I guess at the end of that, my Caltex career sort of slowly changed, and I at one stage was selling off all the terminals that Caltex had after Caltex and Ampol merged. And that led to, must have been too successful because like everybody, you hope one day that they're going to send you away, and they did. And I'd already started, I'd organized to start spectrum analysis in conjunction with another gentleman. And at that stage, we were actually operating a small company. So I guess I finished on a Friday, had a little headache on the Saturday, and was at Spectrum on the Monday. So my midlife change of job or crisis or whatever you want to call it. So since then, Spectrum's now been going over 25 years, and we are a group of eight people, staff. I have eight staff. And we're all about how to help make better business decisions. And our normal motto is using data to make better business decisions. So much of that comes across with site selection, territory planning. We do a lot of work with schools. Anything that needs data and demographic type work to make a better decision than just standing there with your wet finger in the air. So that's how I guess I got to it. And we've been pushing it fairly heavily for many years. And we've been major in franchising for a long time. And we're now quite strong in school as well. So that's sort of my many years of experience leading to where we are today.
Well, you know, and again, that experience in the franchising sector, which you're extremely well, highly regarded as best practice in the industry. You know, franchises are all about not just growing, but rapid growth and strategically figuring out what are the best locations, which is far more scientific than, as you said, sticking a wet finger in the air and seeing if it's a good deal as a real estate agent's come to it. So let's look at an expanding trade business that might have maybe a successful factory or a distribution or a service location in the eastern suburbs, and it might feel that it's missing out on a lot of business in the north or in the west. How might they go about selecting another location strategically as opposed to based on what's available on property.com?
Okay, so I guess we all come back to what data is available to help us with our decisions. So the first thing I'm normally looking at is the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Obviously do a census every 5 years. The last one was 2021, and we'll all be blessed with another one that's going to all happen next year. So we haven't started hearing the publicity, but that'll start coming on. So we're very fortunate in Australia. We do one of these every 5 years, whereas some countries like the United States only do it every 10 years. So by the time they're at 9 years from the previous one, it's getting pretty scrappy. So our census is about a $400 million investment the government makes every 5 years. And from that, we learn a huge amount. Now, I will always say to people, you can always go onto QuickStats. Just Google QuickStats, QuickStats, and it will give you a lot of information. You can look up your postcode and how many people live there and average household income. You can do a lot yourself. But when you're actually in the big picture and wanting to do something like network development, you don't have the tools to sort of bring it all together. So the first thing I'm always saying to people is use the data that's available, or we will use it for you, I guess. And thing is, no matter where you start in, say, Melbourne in the eastern suburbs, we can very quickly look at every area across Melbourne. And I like to explain to people that when the census is done, they start off with about 67,000 statistical area one. Now, each one of those has about 800 people in it, and it can give us the number of people by age, by average income, type of house they live in, all this sort of information.
So that's a lot more fine grained than just postcodes or LGAs. Yeah.
So think of it as like the very little tiles that you're starting with if you're going to make a picture. SA1 have become SA2, statistical area 2, and there's about 3,000 of those across Australia. And they're not dissimilar to postcodes. There's about 2,500 postcodes across Australia. So when we're talking statistical area 2, we tend to say to people, they're like postcodes. But in between that is suburbs, but often people don't want to go to suburbs. Then they become statistical area 3, of which there's around 400 across Australia. Statistical area 4, of which is about 100, and then you have states. So what we've got is the ability to look at any area we want to, whether it be at postcode, suburb, even statistical area 1, and get very good detail. So when we're starting to talk about Melbourne, for example, breaks up into 8 statistical area 4s, and then about 50 or so statistical area 3 to about 300 statistical. So we can look at their area you're looking at and say, well, over those eastern suburbs, there might be 1.5 million people, their average income, all that. Now, over in the north, there might be another 1.5 million. The west is probably another 1.5 million, but growing very fast. So what we have is an ability to look where the people are now, and we also have the population projections going forward. So we take all these things into account with our work. Even if it's as simple as, you know, where do we open a new distribution center? But mainly we're involved with either retail or something that might be territory planning. And we've got to look at the actual demographics of that area and then what is the sort of trade area that we're looking at and have some understanding of why it's going to be good or not good for your business. Now, one of the first things I look at in that is, what are we actually trying to sell? Now, if I think of the high end might be selling $50,000 diamond rings, well, you're probably going to do that a bit better in Toorak or Camberwell or something like that. Now, I'm not saying there aren't $50,000 diamond rings being bought in Dandenong, but probably not quite as many. And similarly, if I'm trying to sell dim sims just as something that, you know, something with a lower price, maybe it has a bit of ethnic content in it, then we can actually look at each market and say, what is the probability? Where are we more likely to sell more of these product than the other area? And what we're trying to do then is identify for the client where they should be sort of working on their network and how many sites they may want to have in the long term. And obviously our aim then is to do strategic network planning. So we can start saying, well, maybe you need to build, here are the suburbs we should be looking at as the best opportunity. Right down, call them tier 1 and work right down to ones that are tier 2 and tier 3 and even tier 4, so that we're looking for the tier 1 sites now we're looking for the tier twos, maybe in a year or two's time, and we've got a few others open. And maybe the final lot is in 10 years' time, we're just doing the final infill to reach a mature position, and they're the tier four sites. So we're very much about helping have a logic and even a statistical-based logic to get to where you want to go.
And so, Peter, I don't know if you can give me an example, but how would a trade business or a business-to-business operation look at these things differently from, say, a retail operation?
Okay, so we look at things in two ways. One is B2C, business-to-consumer. That's typical Ma and Pa Kettle and wanting to buy whether they're food, clothes, whatever, but it's more lined up with where the house they live in is going to be probably the best way of defining their trade area. The whole second set of our business is we do B2B, business to business. Now, we have many clients in the B2B space also, and it could be things like copying, quick copy or Steinorama or one of those. It could be something like test and tag, these tag businesses. Now, they're not really interested in where you live. They want to know how many businesses are in the area and how many people are potentially employed in those businesses. So that if I'm looking at an area like, I'll use Dandenong or Dandenong South, if I'm wanting to sell B2C things there, there aren't many people living in Dandenong South. But then if I'm someone in a B2B business, then that area is probably fantastic for me, because whether I'm having to do test and tag, whether the people are wanting to buy printing and all the different things, that's what around that area. So we'll often look at areas, any area, and we can actually come up with a formula that might say there is 80% of the potential for what you're trying to sell in that area is to the B2C market. So I might be selling food. And 20% is to the B2B market because they need to buy some food for lunch. Then I could go into Dandenong South and I'll probably be saying, well, 90% is related to the B2C market, how many people are working there and want to buy their lunch, and only about, or even a couple of percent, if that, are actually going to buy their food in that area because they don't live there. It's just purely about the B2B component. So that can be calculated for every postcode or suburb across Melbourne or Australia to see what the different composition is.
Right. So you've got the data, or we have the access to the data, which is going to help us understand also the density of trade businesses versus residential housing across all of those areas.
So once a year, the ABS produces a set of data that tells us by SA2, like postcode, how many businesses are in the area and approximately how many people they have. So in Australia, there's roughly 2.8 million businesses that are registered as businesses. Now, only about 700,000 of those actually employ somebody. So about 2.1 or 2.2 million businesses, registered businesses, don't employ people. And think about it like, John, you've probably got a superannuation fund. Well, it doesn't employ anybody. Someone might make some Ugg boots down at Mowi. They probably don't employ anybody. Those, all these sort of things, anything to do with a non-employing business. Now, out of the 700,000 businesses, we then learn whether they have 1 to 5 employees. I think it's 6 to 20, 20 to 50, or 20 to 100, 100 to 200, 200 plus. There's breakdowns. So if I know I've got 10 of one type of business and 50 of another and 80 of one other in South Dandenong, I can pretty quickly come up with an approximate of how many people actually work in that area. And this data gets updated every year, and we can actually break it down even smaller than SA2s, right down to statistical area one as an estimate. So if we're looking at, say, the CBD of Melbourne, we can actually break it down to smaller than just the SA2 of Melbourne, which is the CBD. We can break it down to specific areas along each block to get an idea of approximately how many people work there. So it's a bit of an estimate, but we've used that for people like 7-Eleven when they were opening stores in the CBD of Melbourne to guess how many people lived in any specific, literally 100-metre block around them, and how many people worked in every 100-metre block around them. So they could say, well, where should we open our stores?
Okay, so So perhaps what we should do is drill down to an example, because, you know, an organization that's trying to figure out what the revenue potential is for their business across Melbourne is going to start to look very carefully at, okay, well, where should they be located? And of course, that also raises the question of how does that affect them from an online business perspective, but we can deal with that a bit later. So walk me through an example of how successful businesses have plotted this stuff out.
Okay, well, I could talk oil industry, but I'd rather talk about one of our very first clients many, many years ago was KFC. Right. So KFC came to us and said, we've got to go to America in 10 weeks' time, and we have to show we've got all this good science done. And this is in the late 90s, and it's at a time when a lot of things you can do yourself now really wasn't available. Like online mapping was very basic. Well, you couldn't do it, basically. Google Maps hadn't even come out. So even to just create maps of where their sites were and where their territories were, we had programs to do it, but way less sophisticated. But the interesting thing is nothing really has changed. Even go back to my 40, 50 years ago in the oil industry, 40 years ago, it still comes down to logic. And what you've got in all cases is you can normally get from any client, let's say we've got a mature-ish a business that's fairly developed. So KFC, a good example. So they're able to tell us how much sales went to every store. So you say, well, if sales are going to be my dependent variable, what I'm trying to work out is my gross sales. Then what I'm trying to do is think of all the different independent things that could come across my mind and work out which ones of those, and we'll call them the drivers of the business, are the most important and how much weight we actually put to each of those things. And when you think about how, if you haven't used the more scientific approach and you're just opening stores, there's two ways you've probably done it in your own way. One is called an analog model, where you've literally gone, gee, we've got 5 or 10 stores. Which area is the most like the current areas I've got? And which store is going to be most like one of my existing stores? And that becomes the analog of saying, well, this is the one I'm most likely to follow. It's going to be like this type of area, and therefore I should do similar sales. The problem with that is there's too many variables to be accounted for. So what a regression model does, and they call it stepwise regression, is it says, find me statistically the most important single variable if I'm looking at all my sales against all the things I can look at, which one is the first important? So it might be number of people living within 2 kilometers of a KFC. Just think of it that way. Now, once I've taken that amount into account, what is the next variable that my data shows me is the next important? And it might be, say, number of cars driving past my site. So, okay, let's take that one out and give some weight to that. Then we say, what's the next important variable? It might be, gee, when we've looked at our sites, those that are more visible and people can see do better than those that don't. So that might become our third variable. And what we're doing is doing a stepwise regression to try and take out what we're going to count for and see what's left over each time, like an old long division when you're a kid, and end up coming up with taking each thing out to come up with the best model we can do. Now, in our case with KFC, we're able to show, I think it was about 8 or 10 variables that accounted for, made us understand why the good sites were good and the not so good sites weren't so good. And then what you're trying to do is you use that learning to say, if I've got 100 sites in my network, I'm going to do my 101st, 102nd, 103rd. Then I can now use a model to say, what do I actually expect the sales of my 101st, 102nd, 103rd to be based on looking backwards, the history of what I've got out of my existing network. Now, that's exactly what we basically did in the oil industry too. We would look at our Caltech sites. We knew our best sites to our worst. We knew the variables that were around, and we could come up with some sort of explanation. And this, again, they've always proven that any model moving forward works better than the wet finger in the air approach. At the end of the day, the wet finger in the air becomes biased to what you want to do. You'll convince yourself that this should be a great site because you're basically some real estate agent stuck it under your nose and bought you a bottle of wine. And what we're trying to do in all of our businesses is say, don't be tricked by that. Let's at least make each decision. And when we're talking these sort of decisions, we're probably multi-million dollars these days, even if you're renting the shop and you're paying a big rent, you capitalize that, you're spending a lot of money. And what we're trying to do is help people say, let's evaluate each site in a similar manner so that by the time we're making that final decision, do we commit $100,000 a year rent and $300,000 fit out, that we've actually made a logical set of decisions to get to that point. It can be very easy to and say, oh, well, but John's a very experienced guy. He's been doing this for years. What they've tended to find is by using some modeling, by the time you look at John's last 20 decisions compared to someone that might have used some modeling to at least evaluate good sites from bad sites, it will end up that will be the better performance, will be something with modeling behind it. And I think we all have had those sort of sagas.
Well, look, I think we're all victims of positive confirmation bias, where we start looking for all the things that actually agree with the decision we're about to make, whether it's a new site location or a life partner, and some of those are flawed. But I guess what I'm also hearing you say is that by using the modelling and understanding perhaps the density of residents or the density of businesses of a particular size, you're also in a position to actually project what you expect the revenue potential is of sites and how you would compare those.
Absolutely. So I've always said to people, our work, and back in my oil industry days, was how do we predict the gross revenue? Because after you've got the gross revenue, people then say, well, I want to do an ROR or an NP, net present value, or whatever calculation. It doesn't really matter what they want to do. But you think about what is the biggest risk you have going forward. Now, I say to people, I can do a P&L, a very basic P&L in 6 line. It can't be much simpler than sales going in, coming through, cost of goods sold, rent, labor, and other. Now, if I keep it really simple like that and I say, where is my biggest risk? Well, predicting my sales is probably my biggest risk because that could be out by 50% if I'm just taking a wet finger in the air approach. We might do double or we might do half of what we've written. Cost of goods sold, if you've got an existing business, you probably know that pretty well. You might know if I'm a KFC or something, it might be 31% or something. So you can say that I can apply a pretty accurate thing that's going to tie up with my sales. I know my forecast rent because I've got a lease sitting in front of me and I've got a sign and that's going to, not much movement on that. I probably know my labor pretty well because if I've got a couple of these things already running, I know that I'm going to need 3 people and something at weekends or whatever. So I can predict that pretty well. And my last one, other, is really pretty small. It might be I've got to buy some uniforms, we've got to pay some phone bills and a bit of electricity. Again, if I've got a couple of existings, I'm going to know that pretty, maybe plus or minus 10%. So my biggest source of error is going to be that first one. What are my sales going to be? And I do get frustrated at times with some of our clients and they seem to spend, ages literally drilling down, trying to save a little bit on rent and save a little bit on labor and all this. And yet the first thing, the whole thing that makes the site viable or not is the wet finger in the air on what the sales are going to be. Mm. So if I'm a major investor and I'm going to be spending a couple of million dollars on the site, I'm going to want to have something better than somebody just saying, oh, no, we'll do $2 million a year or we'll do $4 million a year at that site. The first question I should ask is based on what?
Yes.
Because once that's sorted out, I can then do my forecast P&L, I can do my rate of return, I can do my net present value, whatever I decide I want to do. But ask yourself, where is my biggest source of error? It's that first line. And that's really what we're all about, is trying to put some logic behind that first line, not just somebody's bit of experience saying, oh, look, somebody later find out a couple of brown paper bags thrown around the area and we've ended up with a crap site that's not going to do any good for us. So that's really what I'm always trying to say to people, is think in terms of, if I can't think of what my sales are going to be, and we know that we do a lot with franchising, you know, good franchisee will probably lift the site up 30%. Bad franchisee could drop it 30, 40%. You've got to just take that we're going to try and have a reasonable operation, a reasonable operator. Therefore, we've got to try and find that midpoint to at least start with of where our sales are going to move.
Yeah. So in a lot of ways, you're taking the emotion out of the process by saying, okay, well, what are the key success factors that are going to make a site perform? It's going to be the number of businesses in the location, or it's the number of residents in the location, the number of consumers of your product in the location, the visibility of it, the foot traffic, the road traffic, whatever.
Competition.
Competition. And if we then select our sites based on that, we're basically sort of saying, okay, well, these are the recipes for success. If you can then, on that basis, run a business well. And so the running a business well bit is the bit that we're going to take as a given, but it's putting that business in a location where it actually has the opportunity to actually be run well. If you don't have the customers, doesn't matter how well you run the business, if there's no customers, you're stuffed.
That's right. You know, you can have a lovely business sitting out in the middle of 100 miles north of Melbourne, sitting in some little country town, and great, you know, I'd much rather have it in Bendigo or Ballarat if I was going to go to a country town to run something than in Euroa or something like that, just purely on the numbers that are there.
Yeah.
I often explain, when I was in the oil industry, there used to be a company called MPSI. They're international and they were all about modelling service stations worldwide. And they used to have things in four brackets. They would call it, firstly, the dirt strength. And the dirt strength is all that stuff that's demographically related. All those things we can see and measure. So dirt strength would be like population, average income, traffic going past, all those sort of things that if I go and stand in a place and with data around me, I can actually measure. Then the second part of this said, okay, we've picked that this is the areas we want to go in through the dirt strength. Second thing they would look at was facility strength. They'd say, well, okay, we've now decided out of 10 blocks of land we were going to buy, from dirt strength, we bought this block. Now, what's the facility we're going to put on it? And we would actually have markings for facility strength. So facility might be we're going to build a big convenience store. Instead of having 100 square meters, we're going to have 400 square meters. We're going to have 50 petrol pumps, and we're going to have diesel and everything on it. All those things that actually make up the facilities. So we've now got a score for that. The third thing that would come in would be the operations. How are we going to operate this store? Is the operator going to be our own company, or are we going to run a franchise? Are we going to have a good franchisee that's already got 20 other service stations so we know he's going to be really great? Or do we get this guy called John Downs who's never heard of a service station who says he's going to run it and we're not too sure there? And we get that all together. Then the last factor was always brand. And brand was, okay, if we had our dream and we could turn everyone from one brand to another, which brands are actually a bit better than the other? So it might be that branding at a Caltex makes it work a little bit better or worse than branding at a United. I'm not trying to be biased to anybody here.
Yeah.
But brand strength. So at the end of the day, we would then come up with a set of scores and a prediction. And I still use this concept of saying there is your dirt strength, and others use it too, not uncommon. Dirt strength, then you've got your facility, then you've got your operations. Your brand is probably constant because if you're whoever you are, you're probably one brand. But, you know, you could have different ones. Do we have seen that? And look, I mean, ones like Red Rooster could also have an Oporto site. They also own other brands at the Chicken Tree, things like that. They might even decide which one they're going to brand it, but they're all similar. And then you actually come up with a sales prediction. And I guess when you go to that sort of level, you're hoping your level of confidence is going to be way, way better than just somebody saying, oh, look, from my experience, we reckon that's going to be a good place down there. We've got a good deal. So in summary, you know, all these things come in, and I think you've got to do more than just your wet finger in the air.
Yeah. And I guess then when you've got that sort of modelling, that stepwise regression analysis, and you've got a basis of decent data, which is nearly current ABS data, then then you've got the potential to sort of say, okay, well, look, I've got a successful business concept, which I've proven in other geographies. What's the revenue potential for Melbourne as a whole? And what should be my rollout strategy to take hold of that revenue potential over, say, the next decade? Where should I put my first bets first? And how do I then lay it out? How do you handle that?
Okay, so I'll use a client we had some years ago. We haven't done much with them lately, but Amart, Super Amart, came into Melbourne many years ago. Now, Super Amart had, at the time, 17 sites in Queensland, and they were dominant in the market up there. They were spending $20 million a year on advertising at the time.
Yep.
They said, we're coming to Melbourne. Where do we go? Where do we start? How do we get it going? So we were involved in that. So we said, well, right, let's do some work on why the good sites are good in Queensland and why the not so good sites aren't so good. So let's just say, and I don't honestly remember exact why that might have been, we do well in medium to lower socioeconomic areas just because we're not the top of the market. We do well in high density, obviously. We might be the gurus of some ethnicity issues. It might be like we have an Italian brand or something that people are going to love. Doesn't really matter what we do. Anyway, when they first came into Melbourne, they won opened in Ringwood, Nunawading, and we laid out a bit of a network. But then we actually had to take into account the brand factor. So we said, look, if you could have opened that Nunawading store and opened it in Beenleigh or somewhere in Queensland, you'd do $30 million a year based on your study, our study. But now when you're doing that in Melbourne where nobody's ever heard of it, well, you're not going to do $30 million. You'll probably do, for the first year or two, call it $20 million, and then you'll ramp up as people, as you start to become known in the market.
Mm.
And sure enough, that's what happened. They hit Melbourne, did pretty well anyway to start because bigger market down here anyway. And we were able to lay out a network and say, okay, if you do one in Nunawading, you're not going to open then one in Ringwood, you know, 3 kilometres away. Let's do one in the northern suburbs. Let's spread ourselves around. And then now they've been very successful over some years. I've lost track of how many are in Melbourne. But that was a typical strategic network planning job. And we do that on a regular basis. In fact, we're doing one for a steakhouse right now. They've got 13 here in Melbourne. They're starting to talk about moving to Sydney and other states a bit more. And we'll work with them to say, well, this is sort of where you would, where you should open your first few in Sydney, not just wait until some real estate agent tells you where to go. And I always say to people on that, you really want to be proactive, not reactive. Now, proactive is when you've actually had to think about it with someone like us and laid out some areas, you call them your tier one, tier two, and tier three. Reactive is when you walk in and this real estate agent says, oh, have I got the site for you? And next thing you find you're out the back of Beyond and you're wondering why your brand is going to have problems. At least if you're proactive, you tell them or you seek people to look for sites in these specific areas rather than them unloading what they've got. And, you know, my experience is big on this when I was in Caltex. And I used to actually write a property guideline. And this is way back. And the property guideline, when a real estate agent would ring me and we would have three or so a week, I've got the perfect site for you, Peter. Yep. You'll know where it is. And the first thing in the property guideline was we needed blocks about 60 metres by 60 metres because first thing was the tanker's got to get in there and turn around. And someone would say, oh, I've got this perfect block. It's 80 metres long and it's 10 metres wide or 20 metres wide. I'd say, great, can't even turn our tanker around. And then the next one would be, oh, well, you know where our site is. If you stand at your other site and look down the road, you'll see it on the other side. Great. You know, we don't really want to put two sites, well, rarely do you want to put two sites very close. So my aim had always been I would have a property guideline. So when people would contact me, I'd say, look, let me just send you the property guideline. And we had a check chart that said, just tick the boxes like high, middle, low for things like, is the traffic going past high, middle, or low? Is the population socioeconomic high, middle, low? Just things enough that you could get a bit of a feel. And the idea was, as a property manager, was to, my biggest life was sort of eliminating the not good ones quickly so we could actually have a proper look. Now, we used to if I had was offered 100 sites in a year, we would probably build 3 if we're lucky. So out of that 100 sites, my aim was to knock 80 out pretty very quickly. And then maybe I would then take my boss and go and look at the last 20 over the year. He and I would probably knock another 10 out. And then we might start actually putting serious proposal together on the 10 that are left with the aim that we'd probably end up doing 3.
Yeah.
That is typical of when I've ever talked, and I've run a lot of workshops for site selection, territory planning for the Franchise Council. And whenever you talk to people that are in this mature sort of business that have been going for a while, they agree with me. Out of 100 starts, you're probably lucky to do 3 or 5 of what comes at you, because your aim is to try and get rid of the garbage quick and just concentrate on the ones that actually are realistic.
Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organisation Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. Well, you're making a serious investment, and every one of them's got to be a successful operation, because any site selection process is going to result in a substantial amount of capital investment. So I guess if we sort of think about that, that's great from the point of view of, okay, so this is what our network should look like. These are the sites that we should be investing in. This is how we whittle out the 100 down to the 3, which is fantastic. If I've now got a location and I've been operating that for a number of years and it's doing okay, I'm not planning on going anywhere. There's always going to be the question that's sort of sitting in the back of my mind is this site living up to its potential? And more important than that, what's going to happen to it over the next 5 or 10 years? And I guess this sort of question was sparked by some of our conversations about the schools work that you've been doing recently. So how can I address that? Am I meeting revenue potential? And is that revenue potential going to increase or decrease over the next sort of 5-10 years, and what should I do about it?
Okay, well,
help with the crystal ball?
Yeah, what you should do is a little hard about, but the ABS put out every 5 years, they put out population projections by small area.
Okay.
And it's done for a group called Geoscience. It used to be done for the Department of Health. And why it was done for the Department of Health previously was, where do you decide where to put hospitals and things like that?
Yeah.
So the last lot of data, it comes out every 5 years, and the previous one was October 2019, just before COVID, and then the last one's come out in October 2024. And what it tells us is what the population projections are from now, or actually from 2022, because it started off the back end of the 2021 census, out to 2032. And it gives us, by age group, 0 to 4, 5 to 9, 10 to 14, et cetera, right through there. 100. How many people are expected to be living in that area?
Right.
At any time. Now, as you know, John, we do a lot of work for schools as well. And we've now done probably 70 major independent or Catholic schools where we do a study for. And one of the biggest parts of that is where are the students going to be coming from in the next 5 and 10 years? And this data is absolutely important for that, because I'm just going to sideline slightly. In Australia, our demographics after COVID are changing. And the one thing that's happening is our fertility rate has dropped quite significantly. People might know that we had a baby bonus in 2004. Our fertility rate at the time was 1.5.
What do you mean 1.5?
1.5 children per couple, let's say.
Oh, I see. Right. So yeah.
1.5 children were born per couple. The end of that in 2008, it reached 2.02. So basically, a couple would produce 2 children. And this was our treasurer, Peter Costello, doing the baby bonus. And since it's dropped back to 1.5 now, and in these higher socioeconomic areas, it's actually nearer 1.1. So if we're looking at the Melbourne's eastern suburbs, out through Hawthorne, Camberwell, out through here, these areas, you're going to find that the actual number of children is actually going to drop. And an area like Toorak, for example, is going to drop about 10% of the number of school-aged children over the next probably about 8 years. Now, The opposite to that is obviously what's happening out in your Werribees and your Wyndham area, and also what's called Southeast, which is down near Clyde. They are going ballistic. And when I look at the numbers of school children, I think it's going to drop about 3,000 school children less in what's called the Inner East SA4, Statistical Area 4. And there's going to be like 25,000 more school children in the Wyndham Werribee area and about 11,000 more school children in the Clyde Southeast area. But then again, it's going to drop about another 5,000 down on the Mornington Peninsula. So the point of this is there is data there that even when we're going to think about what are we going to build, whatever we're trying to sell, there is good data to tell us, are we in a growth area? Or some of the things we're trying to sell is actually a negative market and it's going to get harder. And I guess thinking of that, when let's say I was selling school uniform blazers for major schools in Hawthorne Q area, well, guess what? We're probably not going to sell as many uniforms in 10 years' time as we are now. Yes. Now, the other option for those schools is to try and get more kids to come from further away to come in. But that's a complete other story. I'm happy to take up at another time. So the data that's coming out and available does give us population estimates and where they should be in the next 10 years, let's say.
And that then gives us a very good indicator as, or some inputs to, as to what their buying behaviour might be, regardless of whether we're talking about flat screen TVs or fast food, school clothing, workwear, and so on.
The other thing I just want to touch on retail, because that's where we started this, is there's really three types of retail if any of your customers are thinking of going into retail. So the first is obviously shopping centre, big shopping centre, starting at Chadstone, Eastland, all this. So they are an animal unto themselves because you're a bit at the whims of Westfield and these type of companies, but let's be honest, they do sell a lot of product through these shopping centres because that's what they're built to do. And shopping centres have been growing for many, many years, very strongly. So if we're dealing with people who want to go into shopping centres, you're looking at things like data on every shopping centre, moving annual turnover, the gross leasable area, retail, how many people actually come visit that shopping centre every year. So there's your starting point of your data on shopping centre. The second type of retail that is probably the main second is shopping strips. Mm. So whether I'm going into Camberwell, Box Hill, Bentley, wherever, there is data again. We create our own thing called Strip Locator, where we've actually got some measurement of how many shops are in each strip. And on the other, and also tie that in with the demographics, we know how many people live in the immediate area. So that's the second type of shopping that's is very common. Now, the difference between the two is shopping centres, you are at the whim of a Westfield. You probably are only given a five-year lease. You're probably told at the end of that 5 years, if you want to have another lease, pay up a whole lot more money and spend money on your shop. And they've got you a bit pretty tight because at the end of the day, if you don't like it, you can leave. But if you've gone and spent $200,000 fitting out your shop, you're not real happy about that idea. So the second one being shopping strips, well, at least you're more discussing it probably with a one-on-one landlord or something. You might be able to get, instead of a five-year lease, which is pretty common, basically the standard in shopping centres, you might get 10-year lease with a couple of options or whatever retail. So you've got more security probably in a 10-year in that type of shopping strip, but that probably doesn't do the same amount of sales as a shopping centre does. So you've got this way up. Then the third type is really what we call a drive-through or a freestanding drive-through. So think of a service station, think of a McDonald's, think of a KFC. You know, they're obviously sitting in a prison. They attract the customer in. They've got car parking. They're a destination. And then if there's a fourth type, right, these days it's developed over the last 20 years, it's the homemaker centre. So again, they've been built to be bulky goods. They've been built to be 500 or 1,000 square metre block. And they're not dressed up or flash with, they're there to sell. And obviously when you're starting to talk bigger size product, be it a Super A-Mart or a Barbecues Galore or something like that, you're wanting the size to be able to do it. And these days, the biggest generators, and we always talk in terms of generators in homemaker centres, the perfect homemaker centre probably starts off with a Bunnings as the customer number one, a Harvey Norman number two, and then, you know, you're starting to get a couple of other really popular ones in behind that, and then you get fitted out with all your Captain Snooze and sleep makers and all of this fitted out. And we even got to the stage where we've actually given them ratings of every one based on what's in there. So really, if you're going to think retail, you've got to ask yourself, where do I actually want to go? Am I heading for shopping centres? Am I heading for shopping strips? Do I need to be a freestanding drive-through type of thing? Or is a homemaker centre my best type of option?
Absolutely.
And each of those have their own, they're different, very different. But they, and some things is obviously much more practical in one than the other, whether you're in a high destination sort of location that really means that you can go anywhere because people will come to you, or whether you're a sort of something that's more of a sort of a, an immediate thought, convenience home. Thought, like a 7-Eleven where you want people to come past you. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're the things I try and get people thinking about. And when we're doing a client, we sort of define with them who are they and what is their sort of main aim. And obviously it directs the whole way you're doing your, where to put your sites.
Yeah. Yeah. So Peter, how are you seeing mapping and AI help businesses improve their performance at this time? How's AI changing the landscape?
Well, I've got to be honest with you, John, and I was actually using AI back in, I had to go to America in 93, and we actually used neural networks to try and help understand prediction modeling for service stations. So in one way, I was playing around in neural networks before the word AI had even come up. You know, to be honest with you, I think you can go into an overkill there, and I have seen companies that do all this sort of thing, and it really comes down to simplicity of looking at things on a map in a lot of cases is going to answer a lot of your questions. And we did use AI with the big job we had with Tattersalls years ago of actually doing sales prediction modeling for the beauty of Tattersalls. So they had over 240 sites that were Tats outlets in shopping centers that were already a news agent. So we had a big group to work with. And the problem you have with using AI is you've got to have enough differences to work. And that actually worked so well that the AI gave a better by about 6% result than doing it by straight regression modeling. Now, we haven't, that's the only time we've had an experience that we've had enough sites that we could actually use an AI neural network type model. And my 2IC is a master's of statistics, and he's done a lot on AI. He wrote his papers on it years ago. So, but AI, not so easy. What has become much easier now is online mapping. And the old picture tells a thousand words is something that is really easy to deal with now. And most of the times we deal with a client, we give them a mapping, a trial of a mapping. We call it Mango Maps. And once they've seen that and seen what we can do with it, very rarely do they not want to keep that going. So an example of that is we do F45 training worldwide.
Right.
And they've got over 2,500 sites, and we run their mapping on a Mango Map system for all their territories across the world. And we then added special competitors they wanted in different areas, certain demographics for different places. And the beauty of it is it's all very doable now, whereas going back 20 years ago, you'd have to use Map Info, or that we do use in our work, but it's a bit like a Formula One car. And the problem is not everybody's going to be a Formula One driver. The advantage of having a system like Mango Maps is everybody really with 10 minutes of quick practice can drive it. Now, I know we don't have everybody online, and there's certain people watching and certain people hearing. But I'm going to just bring up a Mango Map system.
Yeah.
Can you, is that come up, John?
Totally.
Okay. So it's a simple demo one we've done, and we're happy to show people. So it's imagining we at Spectrum have car washes. We've got 20 car washes across Melbourne. So firstly, if I just jump on my site, I can see it's going to tell me something about my car wash. So it's going to be a bit slow. On top of that, we've got Okay, so it's again, just have to change it slightly compared to just look at territories. So I've got showing you the car wash, the territory, and a whole lot of other information. So the car wash first came up saying it's at Bulwer North, and we had some scores like visibility, socioeconomic, how many people live within 2 kilometres, how many live within 3. So we can see that for our area. We then can see here whatever our territories are. So let me just go to a different one. It's going to tell me that the territory around Warrandyte, we know the name of the people and run it. We know the population's 8,000 people, how many occupied dwellings, what their average age was. We can look at all sorts of different data. We can then just as easily bring up our competitors. So they're the little red dots. And we're just handling this by turning on and off the ticks on the side. So we've got all our imaginary car wash full. They're not imaginary, these were the competitors. And we can go and look at our competitors. So Sky Hand Car Wash and Cafe in Nunawading, we can see them. We then might want to have a drive time around each of our car washes. So I'll just let that come up. We can actually, we've got drive time data that shows us every drive time, and it comes out of Berlin actually, how far people would drive. We then might want some specific other things just for information. We might want to know where all the fast foodies are. So let me just bring them up. We're now seeing all the McDonald's, KFCs. Someone might decide that we like to have our car washes right near a McDonald's. So when we're doing the hand car wash, they can go and buy a McDonald's. All this sort of thing is very easily accessible now. The next one I've just brought up in an immediate area is where are all the supermarkets? Where are all the Coles? Where are all the Woolworths? Where are all the Aldis? And this is very easy to do Australia-wide on one of these systems. It's not just Melbourne. These things work international, and they hold the capacity to have thousands of different sites showing if that's what you want to do. So we even come right through here to have demographic information in here. Some of it is just, I'll just bring this one up. This is called SEFA, Socioeconomic Index for Areas. And what it shows us is, if you imagine SEFA is a way of thinking like average household income for an area, the dark blue areas are the highest, through to the light blue, through to the white, and eventually the red. And everywhere in Australia has a score. So we can know what is the socioeconomics of an area. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Average live in a score of 1004, and we can tell that Camberwell might be 1125, Dandenong might be 890, and everything Australia-wide gets a score in between. So the point of this I just wanted to touch on is mapping has become really easy, and anyone I'm working with, be it territory planning or site selection, we will normally put everything on a mapping system so they can see it, and it just makes your life so much easier, right down to even showing territories for people so they can see, you know, what the exact territory is, print the territory off, sell the territory if you're a franchise. It's all become so much easier with the mapping.
Yeah, well, this really changes the landscape from the perspective of where should I put sites? How should they perform? If they aren't performing at that level, what are the factors that are driving that? Is it location? Is it demographics? Is it operator? Is it branding? Is it marketing? Is it drive past? Is it foot traffic? That really helps drill down on what are the factors that are helping us be successful, or why aren't we being successful, which then informs the decision, as you said. How do we use data to inform our decisions around, okay, well, what are our rectification strategies? What are those critical few things that we should do to actually help us rectify the situation or bail from the situation?
Yes. Well, John, we used to, when we do a big job like a KFC or a Tattersall's or something like that, we would do what we call a quadrant analysis. And the quadrant analysis said, for every site, what does the model say it should do and what's it actually doing? So if you can imagine just drawing a square like that, you've got 4 quadrants. So your best quadrant are your stars. They're doing above the cutoff mark, and the model says they should do above the cutoff mark. Yeah. In the oil industry, we would keep all of those. That is fantastic. Your quadrant below that is ones, if you think of an XY graph, are ones that the model says they should be doing well, and they're not doing all that well.
Yeah.
Well, that is Do we need to rebrand it, repaint it, change the operator, do whatever? At least we can think that way. The ones in nearest the XY in the close are ones that says the model says you're not going to be doing very well and you're not doing very well. We call them the dogs. So what happens with the dog eventually? Maybe you got to put the dog out of its misery. So we would then say, okay, they're the dogs. And then the ones above that said, the model says you're doing well. Sorry, the model says you should be doing a lot better than you are. What do we need to fix it? Sorry, I misdescribed. The one on the other side is, you are doing well. We didn't expect it.
We didn't expect it.
So we lay back and enjoy that. That's great. They're great. Not going to shoot ourselves in the foot. But the other one up above is saying, the model says we should be doing a lot better than we are. What should we do to fix it? Now, in my day in Caltex, we would do this same work and we would literally sell off three dogs, sites that not doing well, models saying not good. And we owned land that was in, you know, high value land in metropolitan Melbourne. And then we would be allowed to take that money and go and build one, if not two, new service stations. So inevitably, we'd be selling off the sites around Camberwell, Hawthorne, many of those sites that were worth millions of dollars because of the land. And then we'd be building new sites out in the outer suburbs where the people now were living.
Yeah.
And that's called a quadrant analysis. And we've done that sort of practice for people for many, many years. And we highly recommend it as part of a sort of a statistical sort of analysis of a full market analysis of a network.
Well, this has given us a really good insight to how people can de-risk these substantial investment decisions around what location, what's going to help it be successful. If I'm already in a spot and it's not performing, what do I do about it? If I'm in a spot and it's doing well, what's going to actually happen over the horizon? I guess that then gets to our final question, Peter, and that is, if a founder or a CEO is looking to start utilizing mapping and network and demographic analysis to help improve their business, what critical few actions should they start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I would say give us a call, but that's just a bit biased, of course. But the thing is, I go back to our motto, is using data to make better business decisions. Now, they may decide they want to put on their own analysts and actually invent some money. And I always say to people, especially at schools and things, if you think of this type of work as an expense, you're never going to do it. If you think about it as an investment, no different to any other investment you make in your business, then it becomes a much smarter decision.
Yeah.
Because as an investment, it's saying, well, I'm investing money now to make better decisions over the next 6, 8, 10 years.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm amortizing it out over that period. And this is very much what we say to school. You know, you only need to do this sort of study once every 6 years. And get the mapping ongoing and you will sort of use it for the next 6, 8, 10 years going forward. So I guess I say to the founder or the CEO, if you want to just keep using your wet finger in the air and not investing anything in better decision-making, that's your call. I also have also been the expert witness in a couple of cases where, especially in franchising, where somebody had said to someone, oh, you'll do this amount of sales, and it didn't happen, and it all ended up in court. And it was never our work. It was really no work ever done, but somebody just pulling a number out of the air and saying, oh, you'll do $2 million a month or a year or whatever they're going to do. And it all ended up in a big legal battle. Now, that's not happening much now because the franchisors have learned teach your people not to say anything. And what you've got to say is, if you want to guess what your new site's going to do, we can tell you about some other sites in our network, especially if we've got some company owned. We can say, look, you're wanting to open a site in Ringwood at the Eastlands. Well, come and I'll show you our sites at Chadston, Northland, whatever. And yes, I can tell you because they're our company sites. They're doing X, Y, Z of sales. You then make your own decision what you think the one you're going to do at Eastland's going to be. That's all good. What you don't do is you walk in there and go, oh, because our Eastland, our Northland side, our Chatty side, our whatever side are doing this, 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 and this, we predict you at Eastland are going to do $1.5 million. Your next question after that is practice saying Your Honor after every sentence, because that's where you'll probably end up. So our thing is, if you're going to have a network and you're growing your network and you think you're going to do it just by gut feel, driving around, thinking things are easy, I can only say the long term is not good doing it that way. And most of us may be able to drive around Melbourne that are probably listening to this podcast, but we work nationally and internationally. And the issue then comes is, you might know Melbourne pretty well, but how well do you know Sydney or somewhere that's, you know, really hard to deal with? And the idea of having modeling, and you can use then the same logic, you might have to adjust it a bit, but you can then at least have a logic to say, well, this told us what worked well in Melbourne, therefore let's look for similar places in Sydney demographically and try and learn from this as we go forward. And that's very much what we say to all these clients of ours all the time, is have a network plan, have a strategic network plan, have some logic on what makes a good site good and a crappy site not so good, and let's try and make sure all our new sites fit that mold and we're working forward in that way, not just with finger in the air.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au. Yeah, so I totally agree. The word finger in the air is not a recipe for success. Listening to your real estate agent based on what he's got on the books at the moment to sell you is probably not likely to also be a recipe for success, but probably one of those critical few actions when we're thinking about it is to start to do some analysis and get some data around why is your site that is working well at the moment successful. And it's not just about the operator, it's about the location, it's about the population, it's about the foot traffic, it's about the vehicular traffic, it's about a whole bunch of things, including brand fit out, et cetera, et cetera. And start thinking about what are those attributes so that you can then get some support to do the analysis as to where you might be able to replicate those sorts of attributes for a future success. Would that be right?
Absolutely. And I guess if one of my last words in this conversation is to be proactive, not reactive. And if you just say, look, everything we've done so far has been, well, you may have been partly proactive, you may have been partly reactive. But if you say, in the future, we want to be proactive and actually tell the real estate agents where we want to go and get them working for us like that, and not be reactive because they happen to have a store they can't get rid of on their books, they're trying to get us to take it on, I think you'll be making a lot better operation with your business. So that, and, you know, use data to make better business decisions have really been our mantras for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, a lot of those insights you're actually incorporating into the ebook that all accompanies this episode, so that we can actually look at what are those key success factors and look at some of the ways that we can actually slice and dice the data. Peter, this has been absolutely fantastic. It's always a delight to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, John. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualized business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.